The lesson that we are continuing tonight is one that we started this morning, doing an overview of Revelation. We've been doing a long series going through each of the books of the Bible and giving a short summary of the books. It's hard to do a short summary of Revelation, so it ends up being a two-part lesson. We talked about the dating of Revelation. And we noted, where we left off this morning, is that we noted that if you look at the external evidence about the dating of the book, the greater weight is towards that of being written during Domitian's reign. Though there is a debate about whether it's written during Nero's reign or Domitian's reign, the external evidence, if you look at it with a pretty non-judgmental view, the weight of the evidence really is on Domitian's reign. But let's look at a few of the things that are internal in the book and also see if there's some clues there as well as far as when it was written. Now, one of the things we need to take note of is that Paul is the one who helped start the church at Ephesus. He's the one who went there in Acts chapter 19. And it was in the latter part of Claudius' reign when he did that. In Ephesians chapter 1 and in verse 15, Ephesians chapter 1, which will be where we begin, and in verse 15, it says, "For this reason too I have heard of the faith in the Lord Jesus which exists among you and your love for all the saints." I want to point out, when Ephesians was written, Paul had praise for their love and for their faith. Okay. That was written probably around AD 61. That was when Paul was in prison in Rome the first time. And again, they are commended for their faith. But now take a look at Revelation 2. Revelation chapter 2 and in verse 4. Talking to the church at Ephesus, it's just John writing. He says, "I have this against you," talking from Christ, "that you have left your first love." Paul praises them, and then by the time we get to when John writes, the church at Ephesus had left their first love. Now, if it was in AD 61 that the book of Ephesians was written, and it's just 7 years later, at AD 60, usually most people put it AD 68, just 7 years later that it was written that they had left their first love, that's a quick turnaround. That's a quick change. Not impossible, but it's kind of on the quick side. If you're talking about in 92, well, yeah, there's several decades there, you could see a church growing cold over that period of time. Again, it's not solid evidence, but it kind of leans towards the Domitian reign also. Another evidence that we want to look at is in Revelation, sorry, got Ephesians on my mind. Revelation chapter 3 and in verse 17. This is talking to the church in Laodicea. "Because you have said, I am rich and have become wealthy and have need of nothing, you do not know that you're wretched, miserable, poor, naked, blind and naked." Now, the reason why I want to point this out is that Laodicea, which is this being written to, is spoken of as being a wealthy city. But in AD 60, Laodicea was destroyed by an earthquake. And they had to rebuild the town. Again, if you're saying, okay, you're pouring all this money into rebuilding the town from 60 to 68, that's not in a very long time to build up a lot of wealth. But from 60 to 92, yeah, that's several decades. And yes, you can see that they got back to being not only wealthy, but also complacent as well in their wealth. Another thing that we need to know is, again, from history, is that we know that Nero's persecution mostly was confined to Rome. Basically, what Nero did was, what most people suspect, is that Nero wanted to have a rebuilding program, and he set fire or he allowed the fire to go out of control in the slum section of Rome, which allowed him then to clear out enough room so that he could have a big major building project. And he blamed the Christians for that. We have to blame somebody for the fire. And so he blamed the Christians for the fire. And the persecution, for the most part, was in that area of Rome. It wasn't a widespread one across all the empire. Not from a historical. You don't see that from a historical viewpoint. But as we mentioned earlier this morning, in Revelation chapter 2 and verse 13, it says, I know that you dwell where Satan's throne is, and you hold fast my name and did not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my witness, my faithful one, who was killed among you where Satan dwells. We noted that there was persecution arising. There were already Christian martyrs. And here in Pergamon, there was at least one member of the church who was killed for the faith. If that was during Nero's reign, and it was in the past, by the way, not current, then it's kind of hard to add up. Unless it's because that's been quite a distance away. We're talking about Asia instead of Rome. Now, one of the also reasonings that's given that this was written before AD 70 and during Nero's reign is because Revelation doesn't mention Jerusalem's destruction. And usually it's argued to say that Revelation had to be written before AD 70. But I want you to take note of the fact is that they're arguing from a lack of evidence. They're saying it had to be written earlier because there's no mention. It's not that there's some positive evidence in there, but rather from a lack of evidence that's going in. And that's a weaker argument. But if you also think about it from writing from AD 96, you're talking about a quarter of a century later, after the destruction of Jerusalem. It's a historical fact, but it may not have been a major priority in what God was discussing with the Christians at this time in the empire. Yes, you know, Christians in, remember, this is primarily originally directed towards the churches in Asia. Yes, Jerusalem, a city way back over in the minor province of Palestine, 26 years ago, got destroyed by Rome. But that's not a major thing for the church in Asia. And so it just may not have factored in. But there is a mention of Jerusalem in Revelation. In Revelation 11 and in verse 8, Revelation 11, verse 8, it says, their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which mystically is called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. And that's a reference to Jerusalem, because obviously Jesus was crucified at Jerusalem. Okay. And they say, well, see, they're going to have dead bodies in the streets of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem was destroyed. And yes, Jerusalem was destroyed. It was still there, but it was destroyed. That's true. But notice that it's compared to Sodom, and that's a city that was destroyed for its evil. And so it may actually be a subtle reference to the fact that Jerusalem was destroyed. Can't say again for sure. These are all small things. None of them by themselves would add up to huge weight. But when you start adding all this up, start adding up secular history, you add up these little clues that are present in Revelation, you still get the majority of weighting towards the saying this is happening or was written during Domitian's reign. Now, the reason why we're talking about this and why we want to make mention of these, Oh, I forgot one other thing. I almost skipped it. We also want to make mention that the book was written prior to John's release. The writing of it had to occur during some tyrant's reign. And if it was during Domitian's reign, then it would have been prior to Domitian's death, which does match up with what the secular history people said. Because in Revelation 1 and verse 11, verse 9. I have 11 down, but it's verse 9. He said he wrote this while he was on the Isle of Patmos. And if you look at Revelation 22, in verse 7, he says, "Behold, I am coming quickly." Blessed he heeds the words of mouth of this prophecy of this book. And then down in verse 9 and 10, he says, "But he said to me, do not do that. I'm your fellow servant and those of your brethren, the prophets, and of those who heed the words of this book, worship God. And he said, do not seal up the words of the prophecy of this book, for the time is near." So it becomes important that the information that's in this book gets out. And that is close. And then down chapter verse 18 of chapter 22, "I testify to everyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this book. If anyone adds to them, God will add to him the plagues that are written in his book. If anyone takes away from the words of this book of prophecy, God will take away from him his part of the tree of life and from the holy city which are written in this book." It's very important from John's viewpoint and what God has said that this book be preserved as given. Because these things are going to happen shortly, and Christians need to know about it. And so all this indicates that it was written prior to John's actual release. But as we were saying, why do we care about the date? You know, we're talking about a 30-year difference. What difference does it make? And the problem is that there are several views of how Revelation is seen. And the date that's picked kind of influences the view, or the view influences how people look at the book. It's a chicken and egg type of problem. But it goes one way or the other. One view is called the idealist view. They basically look at Revelation and say, this is really not a prophecy. This is just a portrait of the conflict between good and evil. It doesn't have any one particular event in mind. So from an idealist viewpoint, we don't care when it was written because it's not about any particular conflict, but just the general conflict of good and evil that repeats over and over again in history. If that was true, though, then why was John so urgent that you got to pay attention to this, you know, get this out, it's coming shortly. It doesn't quite match up. Another view is the preterist view. And preterist is just a Latin word for past. And what it basically claims is Revelation was about the fall of Jerusalem, which makes it a date a date prior to AD 70 then becomes critical to that view. And it's generally followed by most people who are post-millennialists. That is, that they say that Christ already reigned. And so the preterists are basically ones who say that all prophecy has already taken place. We're past everything that's stated in the Bible. And that we live in a era that's beyond all the prophecies. And that's the preterist view. There are variations on it. Some people think about prior to Jerusalem, or Jerusalem's fall, but that there are still some things they're talking about in the future. There's various slides and shades of differences between the ideas. The historic view is also a one. There's variations on it. The historic view basically sees Revelation as a panorama of world history. It's a portrait of all of world history from the first century all the way up to Christ's return. And there's a lot of variations on that again. This is the one you usually see the premillennialists advocating. Or sometimes it's also followed by the amillennialists. That's ones to say Christ is currently reigning. But they look at it and say, okay, and that's why people are looking into Revelation, trying to find hints about when is Christ actually going to come, because they see Revelation as a timeline of all of world history. And so they try pinpointing various events to say, okay, now this is when Christ is going to return. There are variations on that, though, too. Some people say, hey, yes, it's historical, but there's gaps. It's historical in one sense. Yeah, it's talking about a historical event, but it's not necessarily giving us all of world history. Then there's a futurist view that, again, this is probably the most popular among the premillennialists, and that sees from chapters 4 until the end of the book. 4 is right after the letters. That is about the events just before Christ's return. So we're going to skip all of history, and we're focusing only on the events right before Christ's return. And so they're constantly looking for all those things that happen just before. And that's usually where you get, you know, the talk about the Antichrist and the 666 and the numbering of people and all that other stuff. They're looking and say these are all hints that this is going to happen right before Christ's return. And probably from my point of view, none of them are really right. It's a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but I don't think it's any one of these particular views when you really look at it as far as the meaning of it. But you can see where the date really strongly influences what view somebody looks at, especially with the preterist view. It's usually those who are the preterists that are very dogmatic, saying it has to be before AD 70. Because it's critical to their view. Because otherwise it is not a prophecy. If it was written after the fact. But what we're more interested in is, what is Revelation really about? If you look at it as a book, one of the terms that you see over and over and over again is an emphasis on people overcoming. Take a look at Revelation 2 and verse 7. And these are just from the letters of the churches. But it makes the point. In Revelation chapter 2 and verse 7, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I'll grant to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. Down in verse 11, again at the end of the letter to Smyrna. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes will not be hurt by the second death. Down at the end of verse 17, which is the end of the letter to the church at Pergamum. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, to him I will give some of this hidden manna, and I'll give him a white stone and a new name on which to stone, which no one knows but he who receives it. Down at end of at verse 26, which is towards the end of the letter to Thyatira, says, he who overcomes and he who keeps my deeds until the end, to him I will give authority over the nations. Going to chapter 3. In the letter to Sardis, and we're going to look at verse 5. It says, he who overcomes will thus be clothed in white garments, and I will not erase his name from the book of life, and I will confess his name before my Father and before my angels. In chapter 3 and verse 12, which is the church of Philadelphia, it says, he who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he will not go out from it anymore. And I'll write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down from heaven, from my God and my new name. And then verse 21, which is his church at Laodicea, he who overcomes, I'll grant to him to sit down with me on my throne as I also overcame and also sat down on my father with my father on his throne. Notice over and over and over. The one who overcomes, the one who beats, will be rewarded. And this is what the book is about. This sets the theme of it. How do people overcome? Well, in Revelation chapter 12, look at verse 11. And they overcame them because of the blood of the Lamb and because of the word of their testimony, and they did not love their life even when faced with death. How did they overcome? How Jesus says, the one who overcomes, these are the rewards for them. How do you overcome? By the blood of Christ and by the word of the testimony. We overcome through Jesus Christ. In chapter 17 and in verse 14, these will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them because He is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with Him are called, chosen, and faithful. How do people overcome? Christ is on their side. God will triumph. And the one who overcomes, the promise is that they'll inherit it all. In Revelation 21, take a look at verse 7. He who overcomes will inherit these things, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. See, the point of Revelation and what we see in there is there is a conflict between good and evil. There is a conflict between God and the forces of Satan. One of the points that's made all the way through the book is that no matter how dire it appears at the moment, God will win. God always wins. It doesn't matter what it looks like right now. God wins. It is so certain that we can talk about it as a fact before it even starts. And we also find that in the book that God is the one who decides the ultimate fate of all people. God judges. And it depends on whose side we're on, whether we overcome or not. And keeping that in mind, this is what the book's about. It is about being on God's side in the conflict between good and evil. And when you get really wrapped up in saying whether it is talking about the fall of Jerusalem or talking about the fall of Rome, the evidence, like I said, it leans very heavily towards the fall of Rome. But if you're wrapped up in it and all your beliefs are really critical on saying it has to be one or the other, you're missing the point of the book. It's using an historical event to illustrate this conflict. It is historically based. But the point is, we need to be following after Christ. The book has a prologue. Actually, it has three introductions. I mentioned this morning, there's numbers in Revelation, and the numbers make a difference. There's all sorts of games, if you would allow me to say that. There's also games being played with numbers. One of the numbers you find repeatedly through Revelation is three. There are three introductions. And just to show to you, let me read the introduction, the first introduction. Now I'll point this out. And then you may want to mark this as you go through your Bibles, if you read through Revelation. So the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his bondservants, the things which must soon take place. And he sent it and communicated to it by his angel to his bondservant John, who testified the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ, even to all that he saw. Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of the prophecy and heed the things that are written in it, for the time is near. Now I want you to notice that last verse. Blessed is he who reads, who hears, and who heeds. There's a set of three there. Just a little bit farther in verse 4, it says, John, to the seven churches that are in Asia, grace and peace be to you from him who was, who is, who and who was, and who is to come. You notice there's three again? God is the one who was, who is, and who is to come. There's three again. And if you start noticing this, you'll find it all through Revelation. Constantly set to three. So it's not surprising there's three introductions. The first introduction is basically a prologue. It sets the theme of the book. The second introduction is a salutation. It says who's addressed to. It's to the seven churches in Asia. And verses 4 through 8. And then the book is really about Christ. Christ as he who is risen from the dead, who still now lives. And it's an introduction to who Christ is. And it's in Revelations 1, verse 9 through 20. Now, we don't have time to go digging through and reading all this and pulling out all the meanings. Otherwise, we won't have an overview. So we'll go on. In chapters 2 and 3 are the seven churches. And here again, what we see is again another set of seven. Okay. What we then have is another set of numbers. Seven is repeatedly used through the book of Revelation. It's a number that's picked because it means something that's perfectly complete. That's entire. A good representation. And so we have the church at Ephesus in chapter 2 and Smyrna and Pergamos. And then Thyatira. Then Sardis is in chapters 3, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. Some of these are good churches, some of these are bad churches, some of these are in between. Some got to watch out, they may fall. Some are basically dead already. It's a mixture that represents what the church is like everywhere. They all have different problems. They're all not the same. In fact, there's, I think, only one and maybe two that are actually in that list that actually has all good things said about them and nothing bad. Most of the churches have problems. Well, look around the United States. Look around the world. Most churches have problems. And that's what we see in Revelation. Then we move on to a view of heaven. It's in chapters 4 and 5. Chapter 4 introduces us to the view of the throne of God and what's happening in heaven. And again, we've got to realize this is symbolic. You know, it talks about it in figurative language. It talks about it. In a sense, when you're reading Revelation, you read it as somebody painting a picture, but he's using words instead of paint brushes. And he's painting us a scene, and if we look and read the scene and we understand what the elements represent, then we get an idea of what the whole picture as a whole means. And so there's a painting for us of the throne of God, and we see the scene of the worship of God that's going on in heaven. Then in chapter 5, we are introduced to the Lamb, Jesus Christ, who's shown to be worthy because of what he has done. He is then worthy. We then get to another set of seven. There are seven seals on a scroll that's been sealed up. They are going to be released or broken. Only the Lamb is able to do that. He's the only one worthy to do that. And those seven seals will then reveal what's going to take place. It's not talking about the past. It's talking about something in the future. And we get a lot of people very imaginatively trying to apply these, but we just take them for what they are. The first seal is a white horse, and it represents conquering. We're told that. It says it in the book. It's in Revelation chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. There's a period of time of conquering. And usually back in those days, when somebody had conquered a city, they rode in on a white steed. To show their triumph. Why white? Because, hey, didn't get dirty in battle. So that shows that they have conquered. But then the next horse that shows up when the second seal is open in verses 3 and 4, chapter 6, is a red horse. And again, we're told it's war. So after a period of wins and conquering, there's going to be a war breaking out. Third seal is a black horse, and it's economic ruin. Prices go haywire. Things that normally wouldn't be easy to buy are impossible to buy. Things that should be costly are cheap because nobody can afford them. And so there's just chaos in what's cost what. Things that are necessary staples are too expensive to get a hold of. That's verses 5 and 6. In verses 7 and 8, there's a pale horse. And again, we're told exactly what the horse represents, is death. Which is not surprising if you think you have, you know, things are going really good, war breaks out, you can't buy what you need from necessities. Yeah, death is usually what happens. You get plague, you get chaos in a society. It is then followed by the fifth seal, which we are introduced to the martyrs who are said to be under the throne of God. And they're basically said, okay, in other words, we're told a lot of Christians got killed. And they're asking for God, saying, how long is it until we are going to be avenged? Because God takes care of vengeance. We don't do it ourselves. And they're saying, okay, we died for you. When are you going to do something for this, about this? And they're basically told, wait. The sixth seal is then broken. And we see God's army attacking. In his verses, oops, sorry. Sixth seal is government collapse. I'm jumping ahead. We see the government collapsing. We see the stars, the lights, the moon, they go dim. And it represents government collapsing. And then what happens in almost all these series, there's an interlude. There's a pause. And in this particular interlude, in chapter 7, we are introduced to 144,000 of people who are God's people who are on the earth. And then also a great multitude in verses 9 through 17, a great multitude who are in heaven. So there's a smaller number on earth, and there's a great multitude that nobody can number that are in heaven. And we're introduced to them. And the seventh seal is broken. And after all this chaos and war and problems going on, the seventh seal is broken and we get silence for half an hour. Which is a strange thing to think about. But it's in chapter 8, verses 1 through 5. Like I said, we're not going to go through all the meanings of this. But rather just lay out, well, here's what is in the book. In fact, the way it's laid out, a lot of people look at it and say, okay, the way it's laid out because there's the interlude and then the seventh. The seventh really is the setup for the next set. Then the next set actually takes place during the last one. So in other words, instead of seeing these as one thing after another, each of the sets are basically bringing us a view from a different viewpoint. This is one way to look at what's going to happen. Now we're going to switch views and look at it a different way. We have seven trumpets. Trumpets are used for warning. It's in chapters 8, verse 6, down to chapter 11, verse 19. And there are seven trumpets that are giving warning. The first trumpet sounds and there are meteorites, basically. To put it in more simpler terms, that destroy a third of the earth. The whole earth is not destroyed. A third of it is destroyed. In verse 7. Second trumpet sounds and a volcano erupts. And it probably represents government toppling because government is supposed to be a stable commodity. Volcanoes are not stable. They're not mountains that stay still. But a volcano erupts at verses 8 and 9. The third trumpet sounds, and then we have wormwood, which is bitterness, in Revelations 8, verses 10 through 11. Fourth trumpet sounds, and lights are removed. The stars, the sun, the moon, again, similar type of thing. But the indication here is that we're losing wisdom, which is, again, something God has done to nations in the past. They start making really dumb decisions. In Revelation chapter 8, verses 12 through 13. It is then followed by the fifth trumpet, which sounds, and we have a plague of locusts. But they're not really locusts. They're Satan's army. They're brought up from the abyss. And Satan attacks. What's fascinating, though, is the attack here is against the very his own people. The very ones that he has already. It's not attack against the church, it's attack against his own people. And it's in Revelation 9, verses 1 through 12. The sixth trumpet sounds, and God's army attacks in response. Verses 13 through 21 of chapter 9. And then we get another interlude. Another pause. This time we are introduced in chapter 10 to a little book. And this is a very similar to some of the things that are in the Old Testament. Ezekiel, Jeremiah are all, both involved with the eating of a book. And here again, we have a little book that's introduced to us. And then in the next chapter, we have two witnesses that are told, we're talked about, that serve as evidence of some sort. But then the seventh trumpet sounds in Revelation 11, verses 15 through 19, and there is triumph. God wins. Which then brings us to the next view. Those are seven again. This time we do it seven personages. I guess the best word I could come up with. We got seven people. And some of them are not really people, but we've got seven entities. And it really explains then the spiritual events that are going on behind the scenes. What's really going on? We see the chaos in government. We see all this other, the warnings that are going about. But what's really driving this behind the scenes? Why is this occurring? This is what the seven explains. We're introduced to a woman who is described basically as God's people through the ages. In Revelation 12, verse 1, we're introduced to the child, and it's obviously referring to Christ. In Revelation 12, verse 2. And then we're also then introduced to a great red dragon, which we are told later is Satan. In Revelation 12, verses 3 through 4, and Satan is trying to destroy the child before the child can do anything. But he fails. Verses 5 and 6, both the woman and the child flee. The child is taken up to heaven, and the woman flees into the wilderness. Dragon tried to stop what God was doing and failed. And so, in 12 verses 7 through 13, we are introduced to yet another person, Michael the archangel, because Satan takes his war to heaven directly. And he does battle against Michael and the army, loses. And he's cast to the earth. And in verses chapter 12, verses 13 through 17, we're told, watch out, basically watch out because now Satan's on earth and he's making war. And so the battle then proceeds on the earth, which then leads us up to being introduced to the two beasts. There is a sea beast in Revelation 13, verses 1 through 10. And if you work through the symbols, you will realize that the sea beast is basically the government. But if we find out, it's a mouthpiece for Satan. And then it's followed by a land beast, which is the religion. And we find out it's a mouthpiece for Satan too. In fact, it kind of looks like Satan. So we got both government and religion working together, one supporting the other, and both of them under the control and influencing people towards Satan. And then in Revelation 14, we're introduced to the Lamb. The one that we were told about at the beginning, Jesus Christ, comes onto the scene. He was also the child, but now he's here as the Lamb, the one who was slain. And in there we have an interlude in Revelation 14. Again, we come back to the 144,000, but this time they're sealed. They're protected by God. They're marked out as being His people. And in that interlude, we have three angels making a dire announcement as they get prepared. And the announcement is basically a preparation for the war that breaks out with Christ leading it. In Revelation 14, verses 14 through 20. And here we went through. Now we know the background. Now we know why it's happening. Which then brings us to seven bowls. And we're told these are seven bowls of wrath. These are God's anger. These are how God's taking out His retribution during this time. There's a time of preparation in chapter 15, verses 1 through 8. Then the first bowl is poured out on the earth and its malignant sores. In fact, if you read through each one of them, it's very much remnant of the 10 plagues of Egypt. They're similar but different to the 10 plagues of Egypt. So malignant sores break out in chapter 16, verses 1 through 2. Second bowl is poured out and the sea turns to blood in verse 3. Third bowl is poured out, and now all the fresh water, the rivers and the springs, turn to blood. Verses 4 through 7. Fourth bowl is poured out, and we have a scorching sun. Desert conditions or famine type of conditions. Verses 8 and 9 of chapter 16. Fifth bowl is poured out, and there's darkness and pain. Again, a reminder of what happened to Egypt. Because there was a plague of darkness there in chapter 16, verse 10 through 11. Sixth bowl is poured out and the Euphrates dries up. Right? It'd be like basically equivalent, in, if you want to put it in the United States terms, it'd be equivalent to saying the Mississippi dries up. It's a huge, gigantic river, and the very idea of it being dried up is just impossible. But that's what the symbolism is there. And again, we have an interlude. Chapter 16, verses 13 through 16, we're introduced to three unclean spirits. And then the seventh bowl is poured out into the air instead of onto the earth. All the other ones are poured on the earth. The seventh bowl is poured into the air. And that becomes significant because Satan is the prince of the air. God's wrath is poured out into the air, and Satan is defeated. Notice each of the seven, basically as you go through and get down to the last one, it ends up with God winning. And Satan's defeat. And then we come to another section. This one describes the war. We are introduced to the great harlot in Revelation chapter 17. It's described in great detail about all the sins and the wickedness that's going on. And then in chapter 18, we are told about the fall of Babylon the Great. Now again, we got to realize that this is symbolic. Babylon is a city that no longer exists. It was destroyed a long time ago. But, so this is a representation of some other city. And its fall. And then victory is declared. What's interesting is the harlots we're told about, we're told that it's going to fall, and then victory is declared in chapter 19, verses 1 through 6. We haven't got to the war yet, but the victory is declared. There is a marriage supper in chapters 19, verses 7 through 10, where the church is, would be married to the Lamb. And then Christ comes as a conquering warrior. And He defeats all His enemies. Chapter 19, verse 19 to 20, verse 3. And then we have a section. Oops, I got the repeated my verses. The conquering warrior should have been 11 through 18, sorry. Mistype on the PowerPoints. And then we get a cleanup. After a war is done, you got to put things back together. You can't just leave it all in chaos. And so 19 to 20 verse 3 is judgment on those involved. It is then followed by what then occurs in the future. There's a reign for 1,000 years, which is where the millennialisms come in. Whether you say post-millennial, pre-millennial, amillennial, it's coming from chapter 20, verse 4 through 6, the 1,000-year reign of Christ, which is then followed by the ultimate destruction. Satan's been destroyed. His power has been crippled. His followers have been destroyed. But after the 1,000-year reign, then there's an actual ultimate destruction of all evil. In chapters 20, verses 7 through 15. And coming on the scene after the destruction of evil is a new heaven and a new earth. It's a description of heaven. And it's in chapter 21:1 to chapter 22, verse 5. And then the conclusion of Revelation then gives us the meaning of the whole book. We had it read for us this morning in chapter 22, verses 6 through 21. It's a summary of the whole thing. There's an invitation basically saying, hey, God's going to win. Are you going to join the winning side or not? Because God's offering you to come over to His side. Because He's going to win. So you can choose to be with the losers, or you can come over to the winning side. That's basically what the end of the Revelation is about. One of the things I want to do real quickly, I'm not going to take time to read all this, but I'll give you the verses and I'll tell you what they're about. But it's very interesting. We start off the Bible with Genesis, and we end with the book of Revelation. Now, yeah, Revelation does talk about the future, but so does, you know, 1 Thessalonians and 2 Thessalonians talk about the future. It talks about the end. Why is Revelation at the end? And one of the things that's interesting is there's a lot of similarity, or actually a lot of contrast, between Genesis and Revelation. For instance, in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1, there's the creation of the heavens and the earth. In Revelation 21 verse 1, Revelation 21 verse 1, there's a promise of a new heaven and a new earth, a different one. God created light and dark in chapter 1 verse 5. But in Revelation 21 verse 25, it says there will be no night. Light and dark were created, but the new ones, there is not going to be any night. In Genesis 1 verse 16, God created the sun and the moon. But in Revelation 21, verse 23, we're told there will be no need for a sun or a moon. We won't need them, those physical things. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 17, man sinned and death enters the world. But in Revelation 21, verse 4, there will be no death. Death is gone. In Genesis chapter 3, verse 1, Satan enters the world and tempts Eve. But in Revelation 20, verse 10, that problem is taken care of. Satan is no longer a problem. He has been cast into hell. The Garden of Eden, which man fell and sin entered the world from that garden, in Genesis 3, verses 6 through 7, we're told in Revelation 21, verse 27, that in that city, there is no defilement. There is no sin. No sin can enter into it. So sin went out from the garden, but now the city, no sin can enter into it. In Genesis 3, verses 8 through 10, all association with God stopped because of man's sin. God used to walk in the garden. We know mankind would no longer be associated with God in a close way. But in Revelation 21, verse 3, we now live with God. And we are with God constantly. Genesis 3, verse 13, we can look at it as Satan's triumph. He calls man to sin. He ruined God's creation. But in Revelation 20, verse 10, and in 22, verse verse 3, we see that Christ triumphs. In chapter 3, verse 16, the woman's given the problem of the sorrow being multiplied. Going back again to 21, verse 4, there is no more sorrow, no more pain. In chapter 3, verse 17, the ground is cursed. And it specifically says in Revelation 22, verse 3, it says there is no more curse. In Genesis 3, verse 23, because of man's sin, man's access to the garden is closed. But in Revelation 21, verse 25, it says that the city is open. The gates are wide open. There's continual access to it. None who are allowed in are denied access. And chapter 3, verse 24, we were denied access to the tree of life. But the tree of life is right in the midst of the city. In Revelation 22, verse 14, it's readily available to anyone. And of course, then Revelation 3, verse 24, man was driven from the garden and no longer could see God's face. But in Revelation 22, verse 4, men are going to be able to see God face to face. This is what God has promised. Mankind, well, actually, we won't blame it on Satan. Satan brought mankind grief, destroying God's work. Revelation is about the fact that God wins, always. But sometimes people look at this world and say, look how corrupt it's getting. Look how bad it's getting. It looks like Satan's going to win. The whole world's giving themselves over to Satan. The point of Revelation is, it doesn't matter what it looks like. God wins. God's going to overcome. And the ones who are in heaven are beyond numbering. Even though Jesus also said that only a few will actually enter. Question is, are you going to be among those few? Are you going to be a part of God's triumph? Or are you going to be destroyed with Satan? We leave an opportunity, if there's anyone here today who wish to become a child of God, there is no better time than right now to put on Christ. And for those of you who are children of God, we'd like to pray with your brethren on behalf. Why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song of the selected.